Empathy is a recurring theme on Story in the Public Square because it is central ultimately to human experience, but also to the worlds of fiction and nonfiction. Today's guest uses empathy to draw readers into the worlds that he creates full of horror and psychological suspense. He's Paul Trombley this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Joining me as he does every week is my great friend and colleague, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, storytellers, novelists, journalists, and more, to make sense of the big stories shaping the United States today. This week, we're joined by Paul Trombley, the Bram Stoker award-winning horror novelist, whose latest book is Survivor Song. Paul, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, so there's a lot that we want to talk about, but first, tell us a little bit about Survivor Song.
So I guess briefly, Survivor Song opens sort of in the middle of the beginning of a epidemic of a super rabies virus in Massachusetts. And really the opening pages are from the point of view of Natalie, who's in her mid to late 30s, or mid 30s, and she's 8.5 months pregnant. And, you know, she's sort of listening to the radio talking about quarantine and looking at Facebook, and there's all these comments like arguing about the virus. And essentially, I mean, the novel sort of opened quickly from there, where she and her husband are attacked by an infected person. And the rest of the novel is really real time, where she and her best friend, who's a pediatrician, over the next 4 to 6 hours of trying to get help.
So, you know, the book is, it's a remarkable read. One of the things that it's getting attention for right now, though, is because you finished this, I think, in 2018? But you describe an epidemic, a pandemic, and sort of all of the human foibles that go with that. What made you so prescient?
I don't know. My next book's going to be about fluffy nice things. But I started it in July of 2018. And it really, the very first, like, what if was, a lot of my prior novels have messed with horror tropes. Like, a prior novel that I took the possession sort of narrative and, you know, tried to bring it to the 21st century and root it in realism. And I did the same thing with a home invasion story that was very much about life in Trumplandia and those anxieties. So this one, I was like, oh, zombie, you know, so I knew I wanted to, they're not really zombies, but I wanted, it's like, how could we get to a story that would be somewhat zombie adjacent, but realistic? And so that's how rabies, you know, initially occurred to me. I don't know, from there, I mean, you know, some of the things that I'm getting credit for being prescient about, I don't think, it would take a mind reader to realize that if a virus like this had occurred during our current administration, that they would not do a good job with it. That said, I use my sister, who's a nurse at a big city hospital in Boston. And, you know, I didn't want to do a book about the national response to a virus, because I feel like we've all seen and read those stories. And, you know, some of them, a lot of them have done very well. I wanted to make it about the smaller local response. So, you know, my sister showed me like what her hospital's response plans were, but the biggest thing that turned the book into feeling like, wow, like this is sort of what we're going through, was, you know, the mention of not having enough PPE. I mean, I'd never heard of the acronym PPE before researching the novel, for one thing. But so my sister in 2014, unfortunately, got a little bit of a preview of now, when during the Ebola outbreak. Now, obviously, the outbreak was huge in, you know, African countries, but here in the U.S., you know, I think we had like 5 or 6 patients, a nurse in Texas, I believe, and actually, like, there was one patient in Massachusetts, but her hospital was going to be the hospital that we're going to take on Ebola patients if it really were to spread widely. And let's just say that our hospital's initial like plan sent out to the nurses was lacking, lacking in a lot of things, lacking in like even being upfront and saying, you know, we don't have enough hazmat suits. You guys are just going to have to wear two sets of gowns and duct tape your sleeves. Now, happily, you know, there was no large outbreak of Ebola here. And also at the same time, the hospital sort of came to its senses and said, oh, no, we would take volunteers and have the correct PPE and things like that. So, so for me, it's been a little bit strange because this book has come out in the middle of this time. It's also really wrapped in worries about my sister and other, you know, nurses and doctors on the front line because they were so helpful, you know, with this book. It's hard for me to separate, you know, my sister from this book in a lot of ways.
So having written this great book, and by the way, it I think certainly stands in the tradition of other pandemic books, The Stand by Stephen King, for example, being perhaps the classic in the field. But having written this and having foretold, as it were, much of what's happening now, is there anything now that is surprising you? And now we're talking, obviously, the summer of 2020, and we're several months into the pandemic, which has hit the United States harder than any other country, and of course hit Massachusetts early on very hard, New York early on, and now we're seeing Texas and Florida. Long way of saying, does anything now surprise you that you're seeing in the real world?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I mean, the list is long, but, you know, in the novel, there is a scene where the two main characters, you know, I do want to say for readers out there that the book does, I hope the takeaway is like the friendship of the two main characters in the book, you know, besides sort of the weirdness of how it's playing out before us today. But in the novel, there's a scene with some conspiracy theorists, you know, some right-wing conspiracy theorists, you know, that talk about, oh, the virus has come from, you know, another source, et cetera, et cetera. Again, I didn't think that was hard to predict that there would be conspiracy theories. The thing that surprised me and has disappointed me is how mainstream that has become in our country. So where, I still cannot believe that a pandemic could be politicized to the amount that it has been, in terms of just the very act of wearing a mask, you know, makes you a political target, you know, in many parts of this country.
So talk a little bit about how you became a writer. You have, as I understand it, you have a degree in math, a undergraduate degree, and also a doctoral degree. Is that correct?
Master's. Yeah, a master's. Make it.
but you're a mathematician by education, and yet you became this incredible writer. How did that happen? Were you interested in writing as a kid? And tell us that story, because it's fascinating how you can go from math to writing. I think there are some related skills, certainly, but tell us your story.
Yeah, I mean, I think my path to writing might be, you know, different than many writers, because, you know, as a child, I don't know, I grew up, you know, just outside of Boston, just north of Boston. You know, so I mean, I was like a short, skinny kid, but I wanted to be Larry Bird. I mean, I wasn't a kid reading books. I was a kid, you know, sitting by himself in his backyard just shooting hoops. And that was sort of my dream, which obviously never came true.
The 1986 Celtics, obviously, was
absolutely, yeah.
You were glued, yeah.
You know, so fast forward, I went to Providence College with Jim. Friars. and I graduated high school in 1989, and I don't know, like the idea of college wasn't as high pressured and ingrained into society as it is now. So I just kind of like, oh, I guess I'll go there. I guess I'll do math because that's what I'm best at. You know, there wasn't really a whole lot of forethought on my part of it. You know, so I graduated, and I similarly, with a laissez-faire attitude, applied to graduate schools. But when I got to graduate school, and actually right before I left Providence College, my last class that I took at PC was basically an English Lit 101, fulfilling a requirement that I hadn't fulfilled. And that class really sort of opened my eyes. Now, I remember reading Joyce Carol Oates' story, Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been? And I remember reading that story and putting it down and thinking, I didn't know people wrote things like this. And on the heels of that, my girlfriend, Lisa, who's now my wife, bought me Stephen King's The Stand, which you mentioned earlier, for my 22nd birthday. So the combination of that book and that story, when I went off to Vermont for 2 years to get my master's, I fell in love with reading. Just I read all the King that I could get. And from King, I moved on to like Shirley Jackson, Peter Straub, et cetera. And when I got my master's and got my first high school math teaching job, I had at the same time this weird itch to try to write a story. And that was, you know, mid to late 90s. And at the beginning, it was very much a hobby. I wasn't super serious about it. I was also trying to teach myself how to play guitar. Honestly, if I had my druthers, if I could go back in time, I would still try to make myself like a punk metal guitar hero. But I quickly found out I was a better writer than musician. Just sort of, I don't know. It's been a sort of slow, steady climb. Just stuck with it. And got Paul, better just by dumb persistence.
Paul, can you pinpoint the moment when you decided this hobby was something more than a hobby? Something when you realized that you had something you wanted to actually publish and put it in front of other people?
Even when it was a hobby, I felt like it was also a different publishing climate. When I wrote things, I was like, I'm never going to just put this online for free. I'm not going to give it away. Even if they're only going to pay me $10, I need to be paid something because writing for me and still is, it's very hard. I'm not just going to give it away. So, you know, I didn't have dreams early on of, you know, publishing big. So I was essentially writing exclusively short stories and sending them to small magazines. But I would say after my son was born in 2000, for whatever reason, I started getting a lot more serious. And in 2003, I wrote a complete novel that I was actually proud of. And it wasn't horror. It was a sort of goofy comedy set in and around Boston about a character who had the fear of the inability to complete simple tasks. Like he couldn't tie his tie without like breaking down. So it was just sort of this weird book. And I spent 2 years, literally 2 years, hunting for an agent, collected hundreds of rejects. But it only takes one. And then in 2006, my current agent responded and said, hey, I think this is a hard sell, but I think you're really talented. I'd like to work with you. And yeah, but he was right. We were unable to sell it. But, you know, having an agent in place for the next book was, you know, huge. Yeah, and I'm very fortunate that my agent, Steven, is still my agent. That's very unusual in this business to have the same agent for, geez, going on 14 years now.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me as he does every week in the co-host chair is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter too at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Paul Trombley, one of the best writers working in horror and psychological thrillers today. His new book is Survivor Song, set in a pandemic-plagued world. Paul is on Twitter too at Paul G. Trombley. That's PaulGTremblay.
So you said that the first Stephen King book you read was The Stand. And I can tell you from my own experience, the first Stephen King book I read, and this was when you were much younger, was Salem's Lot. And it totally blew me away. And it started actually my second career as a horror writer. You have mentioned that you have not reread The Stand. You've reread many other King books, but you have not reread The Stand because it stays with you. Talk about that, because that is really the power of writing. If something stays with you so strongly, you don't feel you need to reread it to remember. It's just there. It's almost in your DNA, you might say.
Yeah, I also admit part of it is like rereading the unabridged 1,100 page book is an undertaking, and I don't like everybody else is so busy, you know, it's hard.
That's true.
Yeah, it's hard to find time for a reread. But now there are so many of those, like, I don't know, early, like it could be a movie or it could be a book, like those early things that really sort of excited you and made you someone into a, you know, a film fan or a reading fan. No, but that book, you know, I vividly remember the scene in the Lincoln Tunnel, for example. You know, I would want to, and I'm sure I will at some point reread that scene someday. When the musician, you know, has to navigate the darkened Lincoln Tunnel after, you know, the whole world has succumbed to Captain Trips. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the book is there. And it's funny, as a reader, part of what drives me as a writer sometimes is that I didn't have an English major and I never took any writing classes. I have like a self-esteem issue with that. I'm like weirdly proud of it, but also like have a lack of self-esteem. So I always feel like I'm trying to catch up. So I'm trying to read as many books as I can, you know, because I feel like I'm 20 years behind everybody else who is an English major, or so many of my writer friends who have English degrees.
So when you read The Stand, what was it that so captivated you? Because that was written at an early stage of King's career, when he was disparaged by the New York Times and other critics as just another horror writer. He, of course, has since then claimed his rightful place as one of the great writers in America ever, and because he's done non-horror too, but also for his horror. What right. was it, the language? Was it the action? Was it the way he put sentences together? Was it the construct? Was it how it scared you? What was it that just drew you in and really seems to have reshaped your direction in some sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, and with all the best of King's work, it's his character work. You know, it's like, you know, come for the horror, but stay for the characters. I mean, I've always been drawn and repelled, because I'm a lifelong card-carrying scaredy cat too. but no, it's, I think what set Stephen and what it's made him so popular is the characters that he creates. And, you know, that's something as a writer that I really try to focus on myself is, you know, my interest as both a reader and a writer is character first. And I also, with Stephen, I think that, you know, he was mainly, especially then in the 70s and 80s, was writing about, you know, working class sort of quote unquote blue collar characters. You know, my dad worked in the Parker Brothers toy factory for 25 years. My mom was a bank teller. These were, you know, the characters that he wrote about were people that I felt like I knew. And that was really yeah. exciting to me.
So yeah, Paul, let's talk about the tweet. This is August 19th, 2015. The tweet is from Stephen King, and it says, "A Head Full of Ghosts," which is a previous novel by Paul Tremblay, "scared the living hell out of me, and I'm pretty hard to scare." Stephen King tweeted that about your previous novel. Tell us about that moment. How did you learn about the tweet, and what did it mean to you?
Oh, I mean, it remains like one of my top, three professional moments of my writing career. The best part was I was not expecting it. The novel had come out in early June. You know, I tried sending him a novel through his personal assistant, but you know, she was very nice, but up front to me, he's like, he gets hundreds of books. He walks through a room like full of books. He'll pick one. Odds are, you know, he probably won't get to it. So now it was, as you mentioned, August 18th, 2015, which I have tattooed across my chest.
you should, actually. It's quite an honor.
Now I was home, like, we just bought, like, a new dining room table, like, you know, these silly, like, personal things that you remember. And I was moving furniture around. It was hot. I was cranky. You know, school was around the corner. And just like the kids that I teach, you know, I get depressed when August rolls around. Right? August is like the Sunday night of months. Move furniture, like, school's coming around the corner. And then a bunch of my friends had seen the tweet before I did. So, I was getting tons of texts. And then when I picked up my phone and saw the tweet, I'm not ashamed to admit that, you know, I got teary-eyed. That he was someone I became a reader because of his work, never mind a writer. So. I'm also not ashamed to admit that I stopped doing everything that I was doing, just opened my laptop, grabbed a six pack out of my fridge, and just, you know, enjoyed having a one-man party watching everyone react to the tweet.
Well, it was certainly a moment of triumph. Have you met King? There was a reference I saw that you took a course. It wasn't clear to me whether that was an in-person course or maybe I even got that wrong, but have you met King?
I've never met him in person. We've since exchanged plenty of emails. So we're pretty friendly. We exchange recommendations, you know, here and there. You know, he's a very, you know, such a gracious, yes, seemingly down to earth person. You know, I can imagine like he's got so many people pulling at him. Even to the point where like I don't think people realize the scope of some of the charity work he does. Really briefly, I had a writer friend who. Burned himself in an accident in his backyard. Like he was trying to burn like a bunch of brush. The wind shifted and he got terribly burned. And like most artists and writers in this country, you know, didn't have health insurance for a bunch of different reasons. And Stephen, I went to him to say, hey, can you, you know, share this GoFundMe, you know, link, which is unfortunately what so many of us have to do to get health insurance in this country. Stephen already had a foundation set up for artists, musicians, writers who don't have health insurance. Wow. You know, and you like apply, you know, and he awards like 5 or 6 per year or something like that, you know, monetary awards to all these writers. I'd never heard of it, you know. So, I mean, he definitely takes care of people. He's a good guy.
He also has a lot of charities in Maine, which is his home state. He still has a couple of residences there, also one in Florida. So he really is a force for good in that sense. Talk to us about how you write, when you write, where you get ideas from. I know actually when Stephen King was asked at one time, where do you get your ideas? He gave us a very flip answer, Utica, as in Utica, New York. That's a true story. But so talk about your own writing process and what, maybe what you're working on now, if you can.
Sure. When I first started writing, for me, it was really a lesson in time management, because I'd mentioned, you know, my son was just born, so I'm a husband, a father, and you know, I still teach high school, so it was a lot of balls to juggle. I don't know, I quickly learned if I had an hour, I just had to sit down and write for an hour and put on headphones with music if I needed to block out stuff. So like, I don't have time for writing rituals. I've written chunks of a novel when my son was at a baseball clinic, you know, and I was there like while baseballs were flying around, but I'm on my laptop with my headphones on. You know, just trying to take advantage of the time that I had. Now I pretty much write at night if it's during the school year or if I'm off in the morning. As far as where my ideas come from, I definitely see myself as a magpie. Like I try to take little bits of everything that just to create my own little story nest. For most of my recent novels, I sort of start with, as I mentioned, maybe a trope of horror, and then try to put like my own sort of twist on it. As far as what's next, I did. My publisher did just announce that I signed a new 3-book deal with William Morrow.
Congratulations.
Congratulations. Yeah. Very good. Great
thank
news.
You. Yeah. With the next novel coming out in 2022, which I'm working on now, about 70 pages into it. It's called The Pallbearers Club. It's so early in the process. I don't want to say too much about it, but it's going to be sort of presented as a faux memoir. So I'm going to take a lot of autobiographical stuff, but you know, it's going to go into a very strange direction.
Interesting. Paul, I want to come back to Stephen King for just a minute. You wrote a few years ago in a tribute for Entertainment Weekly, you wrote, "What I learned and continue to learn from Stephen is that the lift of fiction, the story's effect, is built upon the scaffolding of empathy." We've had a lot of authors and poets come on the show and talk about the power of empathy. Can you explain what you were saying in that context about King and about writing in general and the power of empathy?
Sure. And the idea of lift, I don't know if it was first coined by John Gardner, who older writer, his book, The Art of Fiction, I think every writer should read. It's a wonderful book. But I don't know, as an educator, I've read so many studies about how reading fiction in particular, as opposed to nonfiction, that reading fiction in particular, people who read fiction have a better ability to empathize with someone who isn't them than people who don't read fiction. I don't know, I think that's the job of art. I think that's the job of fiction, is to help, you know, the reader empathize. And to me, empathy and sympathy, nothing makes my teeth grate more than if I read like a book review or someone say, "Oh, I didn't like that character because I couldn't sympathize with him." Well, you're not supposed to sympathize with them. Sympathy and empathy are totally different things. Sympathy is why we are in trouble where we are in this country right now. Sympathy is easy. Sympathy is rooting for the home team. Sympathy is, "Oh, that person looks and talks like me." Empathy is what makes, you know, most of us human. Empathy is the want to understand someone else, even if they're doing something that you don't think is, you know, an honorable act. But if you want to take the time to understand why they're doing it, you're going to come away with some sort of understanding. And so to go back, what I said a little bit before about Stephen's characters, you know, I think, you know, his finest characters are deeply flawed, but he makes you want to understand them. And when you understand somebody else, I mean, it just makes you a better person. I mean, that's, for me, that's how empathy works.
So, Paul, we wanted to talk to you. You described yourself as a card-carrying member of the Scaredy Cat Club, which I find absolutely charming, given your accomplishments as an author. You've won the Bram Stoker Award, what, 3 times now? So that's kind of an interesting detail. But I'm wondering, when you write something, and you know, you really have an ability to draw your reader in and scare the bejesus out of them, right? Do you know when you've written something scary? Can you tell? Do you scare yourself?
I don't scare myself. I'm too close to the gears and seeing everything. And no, I feel like I'm a terrible judge if something is scary or not. And I'll honestly, I try not to think about the scare, because to me, scary is so subjective, right? What's scary to you might be not to somebody else. Just like humor, like, you know, the horror and humor are so closely related. And so I try to just make, I hope that the, you know, the reader will care about what happens to the characters, or at least be interested in what happens to them. Or, you know, I think I can do disturbing. Disturbing is a little bit more universal, and that if it scares them, great.
So we understand that there's at least one screen adaptation of one of your books in the works. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so A Headful of Ghosts is in development with the production companies Team Downey, which is Robert Downey Jr.'s company, and Allegiance Theater, and Cross Creek is the financer. They have a director in place, Scott Cooper. I'm going to butcher the name of the movie he did. His first movie was Desert Heart, but he also did Black Mass, the Johnny Depp, Whitey Bulger movie. And they have Margaret Qualley attached, a wonderful actress, like, who's most recently in Once Upon a Time in America. And so, I mean, it sounds like they're really close to filming. I think they wanted to film this summer, but obviously they can't. So I think, you know, they're eyeing the fall potentially for filming. You know, fingers crossed that it happens.
Have you had any role in the screenplay or approval of treatments or anything of that sort?
No, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah, well, it can be vexing for sure.
Paul, I got a question here that you take a half hour on. We got about 30 seconds. I wonder if you can talk to us about the relationship between the worlds that you create and the world that we live in. Is there a principal takeaway for folks who read your book about that role of ambiguity and reality in your books?
No, absolutely. So all my recent books take place in the now, and I hope they feel like the now, and the anxieties that we have. And a lot of it mess around with ambiguity, because I think that really reflects our existence. You know, the idea that, you know, our memories, our identity are things that are set in stone, and they're not, just like sort of the misinformation age that we live in as well. I think both Survivor Song and my previous novel, The Cabin at the End of the World, deal with the anxieties and how are we as a society supposed to deal with this flood of information and misinformation that we get.
Well, Paul, it is a treat to have you on. The books are fantastic. The latest is Survivor Song. It is a great read. That's all the time we have this week for Story in the Public Square. I'm Jim Lutis. For G. Wayne Miller, we hope you'll join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.